Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, my next guest will be a familiar name to many, someone who came from a working class background and rose to the highest political office in her native Scotland. In her new memoir, Nicola Sturgeon attempts to deal with what she describes as the schism between her private and public personas. One painfully shy and self-critical, the other a consummate public performer. As Scotland's first female and longest-serving First Minister, she elevated the office and raised the profile of the devolved assembly as she sparred with the big beasts of British politics. But as she reflects on her career of battles, triumphs and defeats, where does her legacy stand today? Nicola Sturgeon, former First Minister of Scotland, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Before we get into your political career, can we go back first to your early life? You recall a time where you were a bookish 5-year-old reading under the table at your fifth birthday party. Yeah. You found great solace in books, but also, would it be fair to say, almost happiest in your own company?
Oh, totally. I mean, I'm now a 55-year-old bookish person who would prefer hiding under the table at a party reading a book. So that side of me hasn't changed. I'm a shy introvert. I know it's really hard for people to believe that of somebody they're used to seeing on television and, you know, in parliamentary debating chambers. But that's how I am. I'm still probably happier in my own company with my nose stuck in a book.
So did you have to construct a public persona then?
Yeah.
And this other private Nicola Sturgeon was there the whole time behind that. I don't want to call it a facade, but that persona.
I mean, that's why I find it quite hard to describe, because I don't want people to think it was a facade or the public me wasn't real. It's you know, I'm one person. The private and the public are all part of the same person. But yeah, as somebody who was really shy and introverted, I had to, you know, kind of almost don a sort of persona to then, you know, do what I did in public. And that was always a sort of part of how I went about things. You know, I came to the conclusion probably quite a bit later on that was actually a bit of an advantage, because I think if you are shy and if you've got a bit of imposter syndrome, you know, you struggle a little bit with self-confidence. You push yourself on much more and you have to work quite hard to overcome that. So that leads to you working harder generally. So I've gone over the course of my long time in politics to seeing it as maybe a bit of a handicap to actually thinking it might have been a bit of a secret superpower.
Every time you reach, I suppose, a low in your life or that confidence issue crops up, that imposter syndrome, you do dive into your work. And throughout your life, it seems to have come at a cost. In school, when you were working hard, you say a friend kind of broke up with you because she felt you were devoting too much time to study rather than devoting time to nurturing the friendship. And at various other points, you dived into your work and in retrospect, maybe looked back and said, did I overdo it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably true in hindsight, but you can't know that at the time. And I don't regret, you know, working really hard, and I don't regret all the things I did. On the contrary, I've had an incredible life so far and an amazing career with lots of, you know, fantastic experiences along the way. But yeah, if I look back now, you know, I think, well, I possibly could have done all of that, but also lightened up a bit when I was younger. But, you know, we are where we are, and I'm now at a stage of my life where I'm coming out of frontline politics. I'm still relatively young, I like to tell myself, and I can look forward now to doing some of the things that maybe I didn't take the time to do when I was younger.
Right.
So that's quite a nice thing to look forward to.
Read that one Enid Blyton book you didn't get to.
I think I probably read all of the Enid Blyton books back then, but read lots of, there's lots and lots and lots of books for me yet to read. And maybe write as well, who knows?
Well, we'll keep an eye on the horizon for that one. But, you know, politics, why? It's not clear absolutely in the book what it was, what drove you to politics. It's not like there's any moment there where you were setting out to prove somebody wrong. So what was it got you into politics?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't grow up in a particularly political household. You know, I wasn't from a political family. I grew up when Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister, when, you know, the impact of her economic policies in particular were doing a lot of damage and the working class community I grew up in. Unemployment was really high. There was a sense of hopelessness. The miners' strike in 1984 is one of my earliest political memories. So I guess my kind of entry into politics was from a sense of anger and injustice about what Margaret Thatcher was doing, and I wanted to make the world a better place, and that should always be the motivation for going into politics. And obviously the Scottish, you know, many people would have looked at me back then and thought, why didn't I join the Labour Party? But for me, you know, Margaret Thatcher was in government doing all this to my country, my community, and people in Scotland hadn't voted for her. So there was a sense of, if Scotland was to make sure we didn't have governments like that in the future, we should be independent. And that's what drove me into the SNP.
Although it was an ambivalent feeling when Margaret Thatcher first came on the scene, you were glad to see a woman in power. You felt that she projected.
I was 9 years old at the time.
All right, and you do remember being caught up in sort of the patriotic yeah. fervour surrounding the Falklands War. But as you say, the miners' strike quickly made you disillusioned with that. And how she handled the dismantling or the neglect of industries, particularly manufacturing in Scotland.
So when she became Prime Minister, I mean, I don't remember it very clearly. I was 9 years old, but I do have a vague sense of this. Well, there's a woman now in this big job, and thinking that that was a good thing. And, you know, the Falklands War, yeah, there was a sense of kind of patriotism there. That obviously gave way to a deeper interest in some of the social and economic issues of the time. And, yeah, I mean, that was definitely driven by the sense of real economic injustice. And, you know, when I was First Minister, you know, and the climate transition was starting to gather pace, I was very determined then that that should happen in a just way, that people, you know, working in the old industry shouldn't just be thrown onto the scrap heap, because that's what Thatcher did. You know, the deindustrialisation of those years, you know, inevitable when I look back on it, but she didn't take care to make sure that the people who were losing their jobs and their livelihoods at that time were being helped into alternative. So I remember possibly one of my kind of most vivid, it's maybe not accurate to say it's a memory, but kind of feelings of that time is there was a sense of your dad lost his job. It wouldn't be a temporary thing, it would be terminal. The unemployment was something that happened to people who never emerged from it. And that was the kind of sense of hopelessness that I think Thatcher presided over.
To jump ahead, you know, another woman in power in Britain was ultimately Theresa May, who took over the Conservative Party after David Cameron lost the Brexit referendum. You had hoped initially that you might be able to establish a rapport with her. You found out pretty quickly, even despite your best small talk efforts, that that rapport wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, and, you know, I was as much to blame for that, I guess. You know, she would probably, if she was sitting here, say she found me difficult to establish a rapport with. So, you know, these things cut both ways. I mean, I dealt with five UK prime ministers in my time as First Minister, and Theresa May was the one I had greatest respect for. You know, we disagreed, you know, passionately on most things, but she was always serious in the job, well-prepared, well-briefed. But I think as women, I always thought, and I still think, it's a bit of a shame we didn't manage to establish better personal rapport. And actually, ironically, maybe part of the reason for that is that I think she's pretty shy and introverted as well, just like me. And so maybe that kind of made that more difficult than it would otherwise have been.
Right, you did try and break the ice on one occasion by complimenting her shoes.
Yeah.
And you thought she was going to fall off the chair, I think.
I think it was just, yeah, she didn't know how to respond in the moment, and maybe I'm being unfair to point that out, but it just felt to me like an example of what I'm trying to talk about. We should have had more in common, you know, not politically, but we should have, as women in a man's world, and, you know, dealing with much of the same sexism and misogyny. I mean, she had to deal with Boris Johnson, for goodness sake. I mean, that wasn't easy for her. We should possibly have been able to find, I don't know, more of a bond there where we could have talked about some of these things. And women, you know, and that's going back to the shoe story, you know, women are so judged for what we wear and how we look, and we could have shared some of that. But it didn't happen. And, you know, it might have made some of the political issues we dealt with a wee bit easier if it had, though.
Maury, seeing as you mentioned it, misogyny and sexual harassment, there were two incidents in your political career that you recall in the book. One was a member of the Scottish Parliament, somebody who should have been a colleague, but who made it their business to make oblique references to a rumour, a false rumour that had circulated about you. And then there was a second instance of a rumour about your private life in which it was rumoured you were having an affair with the female French ambassador at the time. I mean, these rumours didn't circulate about other people. They were, I had a particular sexual element to them. You draw the conclusion on the first instance that it was a sexual harassment. You're more, I suppose, good-humoured about the second one, but nonetheless, it was something you felt you had to address in your private life that was based on a rumour that maybe a man wouldn't have had to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, the first one, you know, happened in my early days in the Scottish Parliament, and it was, I won't go into the details, but it was an instance of sexual bullying. And the point I make in the book is that it took me many, many years to actually realise that. At the time, I was a young woman in politics. I just thought it was the kind of thing you had to, you know, put up with and shrug off. And then I remember in 2017 when the Me Too movement started and the Scottish Parliament did a survey of staff and members, you know, asking if they did any experiences. And there was a question about, have you ever suffered sexual bullying in the context of the Scottish Parliament? And I was about to say no, and then it suddenly struck me that that had actually been exactly that. And I think that's one of the things that many women would identify with. Some of the sexism and the misogyny we suffer is so ingrained and embedded that we don't always recognise it as such, and that's a societal issue. I mean, the second one is, you know, how do these social media rumours start and then burst out into real life? And I think, you know, men suffer from that as well, but I think women suffer much more from that kind of salacious rumour mongering abuse online than men do. And I think it's important to talk about it, to try to kind of bring it out into the open so that we can hopefully better tackle it in the future.
One of the things that women in politics I suffer from, I suppose, on one level, is not only their presentation, but how they speak. If they speak authoritatively, if they, you know, raise their voice, they can be deemed as shrill. But somebody you did get some welcome voice coaching lessons from was Sean Connery in the lead up to the independence referendum. How did you end up being with a piece of paper between your teeth in the same room as James Bond?
That was incredible. It was actually before the independence. It was like a few years before the independence referendum. I was standing for the leadership of the SNP, and then it changed, and I became deputy leader with Alex Salmond. But yeah, Sean Connery, big supporter of the SNP, supporter of independence, and he'd asked to see me, you know, to talk about my plans for the SNP, and we ended up in this room, just the two of us, in the new club in Edinburgh, a very prestigious private members club in Edinburgh. And he said that he thought I could do with deepening my voice in interviews, and he was going to show me a trick that he'd used earlier in his acting career, which was to put a bit of paper between your teeth and sort of say things, and it deepened your voice. So I basically spent, I don't know, half an hour with 007 in a room with a piece of paper between my teeth saying all sorts of things. And at first I thought, is this some kind of setup? Am I, you know, am I on candid camera here? But it became, you know, such a special experience. To be fair, I'm not sure I ever put it into practice very much, because, you know, because what he would say when you're doing interviews, just pretend you've got that bit of paper between your teeth. But it's quite hard to do that in the heat of a political interview. But the postscript to that was when I first did First Minister's Questions, as the SNP leader in the Scottish Parliament, I got back to my office and the phone rang and I answered it myself. And I thought it was somebody doing a Sean Connery impression, but it wasn't. It was him himself saying, I've just watched you on telly and the tone of your voice sounded perfect. So I thought that was a bit of a win.
I think the person who arranged the meeting with Sean Connery was Alex Salmond. You describe him as your political mentor. In the beginning, I think it'd be fair to say you were somewhat in awe of his political skills and his charisma, but the relationship developed and ultimately broke apart over time. You devote a whole chapter of the book setting the record straight about how your relationship with Alex Salmond ultimately ended. Maybe we'll have a look at, I suppose, his role in the independence referendum and his stature within the Scottish National Party. You describe him as a high-risk gambler, which was both a good and a bad thing.
Mm. I mean, he was open about his, you know, he loved horse racing. But, you know, that was his approach to politics. He would often, you know, take big risks and they would often pay off for us. Sometimes they didn't. And, you know, it's probably the biggest difference between him and I in terms of our political approach that, you know, I was not as cautious as some people might have, including him latterly, would have said I was. But I was more measured and, I guess, more considered about things. He would often, well, let's, you know, go for it and see what happens. But, you know, he was a big figure in my life. He, you know, was brilliant politically, tactically, strategically. You know, together we took the SNP into government, you know, did amazing things. It's public knowledge why the relationship broke down. But it was important to me because right up until he died, he was somehow suggesting that he'd been the victim of a conspiracy around the sex allegations that developed around him. And it was important to me to set out why that was just fundamentally untrue and a ridiculous notion. And, you know, I thought long and hard after he died, should I even write about this? But, you know, there are still people who were close to him making these claims today. So it was important to me to sort of take it on and show how utterly ludicrous a notion it was.
You ultimately, Alex Salmond, he went on trial after some of those allegations were made criminal complaints. He was found not guilty on all but one of them, which was not proven, which meant he was acquitted on all charges. He did admit to one of the incidents. He said it was a misunderstanding and he had apologised to the person involved. But I suppose there were revelations during the course of the trial that his treatment of women was not all that it should have been. You say in the chapter on him, though, that you suspected that he leaked the initial reports of these allegations into the Daily Record himself, although you concede you have no evidence for it. I suppose in considering and trying to weigh up that chapter on Alex Salmond, why include that bit if you had no evidence for it?
Well, he always effectively accused me or people around me of leaking it. And I know that it certainly wasn't me and it wasn't done by anybody with my knowledge or on my authority. I don't say I suspect it. It's often crossed my mind that he might have done it. The journalist who received the leak, you know, while I think he said the other day that he wasn't sure that it was, he believed it was Alec, he doesn't know who it was. So, you know, none of us know who it was. And the reason it has crossed my mind, and I'm putting it no more strong than that, because I don't know who it was, I just know it wasn't me, is that Alec would, you know, that's the kind of thing, if a story is going to come out and there's nothing you can do to stop it, get it out in a way that you can control the narrative. And what I do know is that, counterintuitively, he was kind of the one who benefited from the leak, because it suddenly allowed him to see he was the victim of underhand dealing and, you know, sort of dark arts on the part of the Scottish government. So, I doubt we'll ever know who leaked it, but it has crossed my mind on occasion that it would have been a very Alec thing to have done.
Boris Johnson was another male politician you came across. You describe him as deeply unserious in your dealings with him. And you say that a woman would never have gotten away with that unserious approach, that dishevelled appearance and the general lack of organisation.
I think everybody will kind of accept that. Women are treated really harshly on how we look, what we wear. You know, women tend, our mistakes and failings get, you know, scrutinised much more than those of men do. So if any woman turned up in politics, any woman leader with their hair all over the place, with, you know, utterly dishevelled, not having read any of the briefing material for the meeting, you know, just tried to make bad jokes about really serious issues all the time, I'm going to stick my neck out and say they would not last very long in politics. Whereas Boris Johnson seemed to, I don't know, sort of develop this as some kind of trademark of office. And I think it's kind of, it crystallises the very gendered treatment of politicians, that men, it's not just that men get away with things women don't get away with, things that are seen in men as attributes, you know, strong, decisive leadership, will be described in women as they're bossy and assertive and aggressive. So almost as character flaws. And there are definitely double standards and very sexist double standards at play.
You write this book, you completed it, I think, writing it in April of this year. You were cleared in March of any charges regarding embezzlement of funds from your party. Your now estranged husband is still facing those charges. Is that what ultimately decided, or the prospect of that investigation, is that what ultimately decided you on leaving politics, or was it entirely independent of that?
It was entirely independent of that. And I totally accept, and I say in the book, why people might look at that now and the coincidences of time and there and think differently. But it wasn't the reason at all. I mean, I set out at length at the time, and I kind of cover it again in the book, my reasons for stepping down when I did. I mean, I'd been First Minister for 8.5 years, but the COVID years made that seem longer. I was at a point where I was just exhausted physically, mentally, and thought it was the right time for me to step aside. And, you know, I couldn't have predicted what would then unfold. But I look back on it now and I have no doubts I made the right decision.
Looking at independence, which was the big issue that drove your political career, I suppose you'll wonder when the next referendum might come. But during your career as well, did you look at Ireland as almost an alternative reality that Scotland could have inhabited in terms of its economics and its independence from the UK? And that, how much space did that occupy in your head as in your political career?
I mean, a lot. You know, I think lots of people look to Ireland and think, you know, that's what an independent Scotland could look like. I mean, obviously, Ireland and Scotland are different countries. It wouldn't be exactly the same. But, you know, the example of Ireland through tough times, you know, around the financial crash, through good times, it's always right to be in charge of your own destiny, to be independent and be able to navigate these things as an independent country. So I think there's a lot of inspiration that is taken on the part of people who support Scottish independence from the Irish example. Beyond that, as First Minister, I worked closely with, more than one Taoiseach. I became First Minister when Enda Kenny was still Taoiseach. Then Leo Varadkar, on great with him and with Micheál Martin. So I had really good relationships with Irish leaders, and, you know, we spent a lot of time and effort on strengthening the Irish-Scottish relationship, which is very, very good shape today. After Scotland, Ireland is maybe my favourite country in the world. I really like it. I enjoy spending time in Ireland because I think there's a lot that kind of Celtic solidarity. I think there's lots of similarities between the Scottish and the Irish outlook on life.
So do we have any idea what's next? You say you may spend some time outside of Scotland. Do you think that might be spent maybe in the US, where Leo Varadkar has spent some time? You say you're going to devote some time to writing. But if you were going abroad, where would you go and what would you do?
I mean, until quite recently, I probably would have said the US. I think I will go into the reasons why I might not be as keen on that at the moment. I love America, and fortunately I'm not keen on America's political leadership at the moment, and it's not keen on me either. But anyway, that's another story. I tell some anecdotes about my interactions with Trump in the book. I've talked about maybe going to London for a period. I'm never going to spend too much time out of Scotland. It's where I belong. Who knows, maybe Dublin for a period. I love Dublin as a city. The great thing about the stage I'm at in life is that I've got these options about where to go and what to do, and I'm really looking forward to it.
All right, Nicola Sturgeon, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed.
All the best.
Bye.
Now, Frankly by Nicola Sturgeon is published by Pan Macmillan. It's out this Thursday. It's available in all good bookshops, and Nicola Sturgeon will be in conversation with Matt Cooper in the National Concert Hall on the 20th of August. That's part of the Boris Festival of Writing and Ideas Summer Series. You get tickets from nch.ie if you're interested in that. Now, coming up, Maura Fey meets adults learning to swim.
Get in touch on WhatsApp 0870 32 32 32.